over momentum, but you're taught that you're not supposed to think of these probability distributions as arising from a joint probability distribution over position and momentum. Correctly, you're taught that. But Wigner, in 1932, discovered that you could kind of do that. You can kind of think of this as a joint probability distribution, just that the probability distribution gets negative sometimes, so it's not really a probability distribution. And that's called the Wigner function. It's a function of a real function of position and momentum, from which you can get the marginal distributions for position and momentum separately, for example. What I'm doing here in this talk is generalizing the concept of a Wigner function, Wigner representation of a quantum state, to apply to states of quantum states of a discrete system, system with a finite number of a finite dimensional state space. So that's where I'm headed. That's not exactly where I'm starting. I'll start by talking about kind of a practical problem, the problem of state determination, and then we'll move in just, I'll say something briefly about the standard Wigner function. And then we'll get into discrete phase space and the discrete Wigner function, which is the main focus of the talk. Okay, so, and Kathleen Gibbons and Matt Hoffman collaborated with me on this. Let's see. That's right. Okay, let me start by talking about a single qubit. The general state of a single, and I'm always going to think of it as a spin 1/2 particle. The general state of a single qubit, including mixed and pure states, it can be thought of as a point either on the surface of or in the interior of this sphere, unit sphere. The pure states are on the surface, the mixed states are in the interior. So rho here represents a general mixed state. Suppose that you have a device that spits out a whole bunch of qubits, all described by the same density matrix rho. So we think of this device as not changing in time. It just spits them out in the same way each time. And your mission is to figure out what that state rho is, because you don't know the device. How can you do that? Well, you consider a test space, okay, and can do some tests on it, some quantum tests. For example, you might do the up versus down test. Up versus down, in this picture, they're diametrically opposite. In Hilbert space, they look like this. In the state space, they look like this. They're orthogonal. And what does that gain? What does that give you? If you run a whole bunch of your particles, your qubits, through this test, some of them go up, some of them go down. And by the fraction that go up, you can tell the level on the sphere of your part of your state. That is how high up it is. If 3/4 of them go up and 1/4 go down, you're 3/4 of the way up from the bottom to the top. So that restricts you to a plane. That's not good enough to know the state. So you take another sample from the same apparatus and make a different test, say right versus left. And that's going to restrict you to another plane like this. That's still not going to cut that. So now you're cut down to a line. So you need a third test, say in versus out, in order to finally locate the point where the state resides. Well, that's one method. That's state determination, one method of finding the state of a qubit. And there is something special about choosing these three mutually perpendicular directions in this picture, which are mutually unbiased in state space way of thinking, in that in real life, these planes are not actually sharp. They're a little bit fuzzy because you actually have some statistical fluctuations, having measured only a finite number of these particles. And because, so you have the intersection between among three finite planes, that'll be a fuzzy point. And you can reduce the fuzziness, or minimize the fuzziness, by choosing three of these perpendicular planes. So let me just show you a picture of that again here. So here's the state determination. You've got all these particles coming in. This beam splitter just randomly sorts them into three different categories. That's entirely random. Doesn't do anything important. And then you make these three distinct measurements, the x, y, and z. And this is going to be my z. This is going to be my x. This is going to be my y for the rest of this talk. Each of those is a binary measurement. And from the frequencies of occurrence, you can figure out what the state is. Notice that those three measurements are mutually unbiased in the sense that each of them defines a basis, an orthogonal basis. Say the X basis in state space, you can think of like this. The Z basis then would be unbiased with respect to that in the sense that it might look like this, that each element of the Z basis is an equal equal magnitude superposition of the elements of the X basis. And similarly for the Y basis, I can't show you that because I don't have complex fingers. In real vector space, you can't do that. But if I did, you know, I could do that. So in complex two-dimensional vector space, these three exist. OK, so that's one qubit. Let's move to the case of two qubits. Suppose you have a source that produces qubits in pairs. They come out like this. They might be correlated with each other. They don't have to be in a pure state. They might be just classically correlated. They might be in a pure state. They might be quantum entangled with each other. Anything that's allowed, that's what this thing might produce. And how are you going to figure out, again, what is the state that is produced? Well, the mathematical description of that state is going to be a density matrix again. This is time it's a 4x4 density matrix because the state space has four dimensions. So it's a 4x4 Hermitian matrix with unit trace, and it's got no negative eigenvalues. And you're trying to figure out what is that matrix. Well, one way to figure it out is by doing the same thing we just did to each of the two qubits, but this time paying attention to all the correlations. So when this one goes to the X and the left one goes to the Z, you pay attention. So if the X went one way and if the X goes up and the Z goes down, you make a note of that. So by paying attention to all the correlations, you can, it turns out, completely reconstruct the state of these pairs. In effect, you're making 9 distinct measurements, right? Because each one of those can be combined with each one of those. So let's call them XX, XY, XZ, and so on. So another way of picturing that is like this. So you have, imagine the little qubit molecules coming in. This is just formally identical. You split it into 9 possible measurements, and each of those is going to have 4 possible outcomes. Each of those measurements will have 4 possible outcomes. Okay, but that's actually not the most efficient way to do this. Again, I'm thinking very practically here. So this is a practical problem, but it's going to end up being more abstract as we go along. So can we be more efficient? Well, look, the density matrix for two qubits is a 4x4 Hermitian matrix. It only has 15 real parameters, it's the dimension squared minus 1, real parameters to specify. So you only need 15 numbers that you're trying to get. Well, and each of your measurements has 4 possible outcomes. So that gives you 4 probabilities. But they add up to 1, so 3 of them are independent. So each measurement's giving you 3 parameters. Well, if you have 15 parameters to find, and each measurement that you do on some subset of your ensemble gives you 3 parameters, then you need 5 distinct measurements. It seems at least you need 5. And for the purpose of minimizing the effect of statistical fluctuations, ideally you'd like these 5 orthogonal bases, frames that you're working with, to be mutually unbiased. In that way, each one's giving you information that's really quite distinct from the other ones. And so ideally, it'd be really nice if you could find 5 mutually unbiased frames for this 4-dimensional state space, 4-dimensional complex vector space. By mutually unbiased, again, means each element of one of the bases should be an equal magnitude superposition of the elements of the other bases, of each of the other bases. Well, it's not obvious that that can be done, but it has been shown that that can be done. There do exist 5 such bases. I won't even try to illustrate that with my fingers. Each one has 4, first of all, and then there are 5 of them. And what are those? Well, here's one way to choose them. You can choose 3 of the ones that we already use, where you're measuring the, say, right versus left. That's the X measurement on each of those spins, each in the pair. And then you do the in versus out, which is the YY. And you do the up versus down, which is the ZZ. And then you also have these 2 funny measurements, which in which each basis element, this 4-element basis, is a maximally entangled state. of the two qubits. The Bell basis, named for John Bell, is a famous orthogonal basis consisting of four maximally entangled states. These are not that one, but they're kind of like it. And so that's why I'm calling it the Bell basis. And then the other one has to be called the Bow basis. I came up with those names some time ago in a talk, and they have not stuck. No one else has used those words for obvious reasons, I think. but I'm still using them anyway. I thought they were kind of funny. Anyway, because it's kind of like the Bell, B-E-L-L basis. Okay. All right. Anyway. So here's what they look at. Those are the actual states in these bases. No, they're fine. They're like taking the Bell basis and then rotating one of the particles in a certain way, one way or the other. Anyway, so you can do this. You can do this kind of state determination. And that ends part one of the talk. Okay, we'll get back to this in a minute. But first I want to say a word about the Wigner function. So just hang on to this idea, this state determination, by a whole bunch of using a bunch of tests which are unbiased with respect to each other. The Wigner function now is a function of position and momentum. It represents a state of a particle moving in one dimension. It's an alternative to the wave function, actually alternative to the density matrix rho of such particle. There's a simple prescription for going from the density matrix to the Wigner function or back the other direction. I'm not giving that here. It's not particularly important for what we're going to be doing, because we'll be developing a sort of Wigner function from scratch for the discrete case. The one fact I want to, so that there's a picture of a Wigner function for a particular quantum state in this position momentum space. That one there doesn't seem to have any negative values, but sometimes it can get negative. The one fact about Wigner function I want to focus on is this thing called translational invariance, which is to say, if you take the wave function or the density matrix and apply a unitary operator that's understood to have the effect of translating the wave function in space, for example, or boosting it in momentum, or both, then the Wigner function that corresponds to that state does exactly what you want it to do. It just sort of scoots along as it should. Okay, it gets translated in position or momentum or both in its phase space where it lives. So that's a nice property that we want our discrete we're going to want our discrete Wigner function to have that property. And let me just note, as I mentioned before, that you can get real actual probability distributions from the Wigner function by integrating it, basically. If you want to find out what's the probability that your particle that's moving in one dimension will be found in this strip. What's the probability that, let me go the other direction. What's the interpretation of this integral? Suppose you have two lines, two straight lines. I've given their equations here. They differ only by the constant term, so they're parallel to each other. You consider the strip in between those, the infinite strip in between those two lines. Integrate the Wigner function over that strip. That integral has a well-defined interpretation. It is the probability that the operator that sort of matches those equations, those lines, takes a value between the two constant values, c and c prime. Okay. So it really has a direct physical interpretation. And in particular, if you integrate over position, if you integrate over position, you get the correct distribution for momentum. If you integrate over momentum, you get the correct distribution for position. But you also can integrate in these funny directions. That works too. So the Wigner function has that nice property. And that allows a kind of state determination for one of these continuous variable quantum systems. How can you determine the state of the system? Well, you measure on many, many, many copies of the system the observable AQ plus BP. You get a probability distribution. Interpret that as the integral of the Wigner function over some direction of phase space. Okay, and then you change A and B, and you interpret those results as integrals of the Wigner function over other distributions. And from those integrals, you can actually reconstruct the whole Wigner function. And from the Wigner function, you can reconstruct the quantum state in whatever form you want to write it, because it has all the information there. You can get the density matrix, for example. This is called tomography because it's a lot like medical tomography, right, where you're looking from all these different directions. OK, we're going to do the same kind of thing with a discrete case. That's the idea. So now back to a single qubit. We talked about those three measurements that are sufficient to determine the state. Do those measurements arise from a phase space, a two-dimensional space, sort of like the position and momentum space that the Wigner function is defined on? Well, I could end the talk right now if the answer were no. That'd be really that'd be a fun joke, wouldn't it? No, you can't, and that's the end. But actually, no. The answer is yes, you can do it. And here's a picture of how that can be done. Okay. So here's the phase space, I want to say, for a single qubit. It consists of four dots, four points. That's it. That's the whole space. Its axes are labeled by Q and P, which are kind of like position momentum. But they're going to be I'm going to interpret them physically in terms of spin. So instead of position, we have spin up, spin down. Instead, in terms of momentum, we have spin right, spin left. Okay. Well, in order to do some arithmetic with those axis variables, I want to assign numbers to them, not just up and down. And the numbers I want to assign are 0 and 1 with arithmetic mod 2. Okay. And when you have the arithmetic there, then you can write down linear equations and you can draw straight lines. Right? So you can talk about what are all the straight lines in this phase space. They're not very complicated. And the Wigner function, which represents the state of a qubit, is going to be a real function on this discrete phase space. Like the regular Wigner function, it won't be a probability distribution. It won't necessarily have non-negative values all the time. But the values will be real, and they'll add up to 1 like a probability distribution. Okay, and once you have this, the arithmetic of the two axis variables, Q and P, you can define straight lines. There are 6 of them. Those are the 6 lines, the solutions of linear equations. 2 lines are parallel if they don't intersect. So I've divided them into 3 sets of parallel lines. Let's call each set of parallel lines a striation of the phase space, a bunch of stria that break up the phase space into lines. So you have 3 of those. And the idea here for constructing the Wigner function is the following. So each striation, each set of parallel lines, will be associated with an orthogonal basis of the state space. Okay. And each line, in particular, will be associated with a particular vector in that orthogonal basis. I shouldn't really say vector. I should say it's a projection operator or a one-dimensional subspace, as Alex was saying. That's better to think of it that way. The phase I don't care about. And the Wigner function is going to be defined so that when you sum it over any line, it gives you the probability of the given quantum state giving a positive value if you test it along that particular projection operator that's associated with that line. So every line is going to be associated with a sort of rank 1 test, you know, test outcome, projection operator. And the sum of the Wigner function over the line is going to give you the probability of the yes outcome for that projector. Okay, I'll give an example in a second. So this is to remind me to say that the next few slides are aimed at assigning in a natural way a state vector to each line of the phase space. That will define the Wigner function. If we can figure out how to associate a state vector with each line, that defines the Wigner function. In a way, I've already sort of committed myself to thinking of this line as being associated with the up state, and this line is associated with the down state, and this with the right state, and this with the left state. But there are still 2 other lines. I have to figure out what vectors to associate with those lines. How can we do that systematically? Well, just as in the continuous case, we're going to require translational covariance of the Wigner function. And so we're going to have some sense of what it means to translate this way or this way in the phase space. Well, going this way, that is horizontally, is a matter of flipping up to down and down to up and leaving right and left unchanged. The operator that does that is this X operator here. I've defined it there on up and down. So that's what it does. And it's linear, so that defines it completely. And then the vertical translation flips right to left and left to right, but leaves up and down unchanged, at least in the sense of a projection. The projection is unchanged. It actually changes the sign of the state vector of down. But that has the effect of changing right to left and left to right. And that one's called Z. So translating horizontally is given by the X operator. Translating vertically is the Z operator. And then we can use that to figure out what state vectors we should associate with these two diagonal lines. Because those lines, take the one on the left there, it's invariant under simultaneously translating vertically and horizontally. Because the lower left goes to the upper right and vice versa. This is how we build the thing. We associate then those lines with the eigenvectors of the translation operator, of the diagonal translation operator, which is a combination of vertical and horizontal. So it's X times Z, which is proportional to the Pauli Y matrix. So it has two distinct eigenvectors. And those are the eigenvectors that we associate with the diagonal lines. And they are the ones that we wanted for our tomography. So in this way, these three measurements that we needed for tomography do come out of a phase space description. Okay, you're not likely to be very impressed by that so far. Notice that there is some ambiguity here. There's some freedom. Although this translation business does pick out a particular frame, orthogonal frame, to associate with this striation of the phase space, it doesn't tell you which vector in that frame to associate with each line in that striation. Okay. So you have actually two choices. And in the examples I'm about to show you, I'm arbitrarily choosing to associate the plus one eigenstate of the y-axis, so just the in state, I guess, with that particular line. And then the other line will be associated with the out state. OK, and so here are some examples of Wigner functions for a single qubit. So here's the up state, spin up. It looks like this in Wigner function form. And notice that the tomography works. If you sum over the vertical lines, you get probability 1 of spin up, probability 0 of spin down. That's correct. If you sum over the horizontal lines, you get probability 1/2 of spin to the right, probability 1/2 of spin to the left. That's correct. And then if you sum over the diagonal lines, you get probabilities 1/2 and 1/2 for spin in and spin out. And that's correct also for the up state. Okay. Here's another quantum state of a single qubit. I think of it in spin language. I think of it as pointing sort of in a particular direction. Here are x, y, and z. Imagine this direction that's sort of as opposite as possible to those three. But it's a negative eigenstate of x plus y plus z. That's what its Wigner function looks like. It has the correct marginals. And I show you that one just because it has a negative value. And it has the most negative value you can get for a single qubit. Okay, that's enough for a single qubit. Let me move on to two qubits, which is much more fun. So you've got two qubits. Remember, we had this method of determining the state with these five mutually unbiased frames. And do those five frames emerge from a phase space? Well, yeah, they do, actually. They come from this phase space, this phase space for two qubits, where I'm going to label the horizontal physically. I'm going to interpret the horizontal axis as up, 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 down, down, up, down, down for the two particles. And the vertical axis I'll interpret as right, 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 left, left, right, and left, left, those four orthogonal states, which are unbiased with respect to the up-down states. But in order to do some arithmetic with these variables, q and p, I need to assign numbers to them. And the numbers that I'm going to assign are 0, 1, omega, and omega bar. Those are just the elements They're not numbers in the usual sense. They're elements of the four-element field. I've seen at least some papers where those elements are called 0, 1, omega, and omega bar, so I'm copying that usage. There are many people in this audience who are way more familiar with finite fields than I am, but I know that not all physicists are familiar with them. It's a funny kind of arithmetic, but it has all of the properties that you might possibly want of an arithmetic. It's got addition, multiplication, which are both invertible, and it satisfies all the other nice things that you might want. Here's the addition and multiplication table for the four-element field. There's only one field of isomorphism with just four elements. And so you can see that if you add any element to itself, you get zero. So it's based on binary arithmetic. And the multiplication has omega times omega bar, for example, is equal to 1. Omega times omega is equal to omega squared. Anyway, so you have is equal to omega bar. So you have this arithmetic, which allows you to define straight lines, because you just write down a linear equation. The solution of the equation is a straight line. Parallel lines are lines that differ in their just the constant piece of the linear equation. And so you can figure out what all the possible lines are in this phase space. Here they are. They make, as some of you have already noticed, an affine plane. So you have lines that can be parallel. Okay, so those four top ones there are parallel to each other. Any two lines that are not parallel intersect in exactly one point. It has all the properties that you might want I don't know who's to define what one might want, but it's nice property, nice geometric properties. And the idea is the same. We're going to associate with each of those lines a vector in the state space. And each basis, that is to say, I'm sorry, each striation, each set of parallel lines, is going to be associated with a frame in the state space. So we're going to have five frames, and we hope that they're going to come out to be mutually unbiased, and the ones that we wanted. And they will. How are we going to go about doing that? Well, as before, we'll define some translation operators for moving around. Okay. So, for example, I don't give all of them here, but just a couple. If you want to move, translate by one in the x direction, that is to say, add one in the field, in the horizontal direction, it does this. It interchanges columns. Physically, it flips the second particle up to down and down to up, leaves the first particle unchanged. And then here's a horizontal translation by omega. You're adding omega in the field. And that just flips the first particle up to down and down to up, leaves the second particle unchanged. Okay, and you similarly define other translation operators in a natural way. And once you have the translation operators, then you can answer questions like this. Unambiguously. What measurement goes, that is to say, what frame goes with, what orthogonal frame goes with this striation, this funny looking one? Okay? Well, those are four straight lines in this geometry. They're parallel to each other. And notice that each of those lines is invariant under certain translations, a set of three translations. And so our rule is we're going to find simultaneous eigenvectors of these three operators, these three translation operators, which do commute with each other. So they have simultaneous eigenvectors. And indeed, when you find those, they turn out to be the Bell basis, okay, one of the bases that we wanted to have. And then the other funny set of lines, which looks similarly funny, produces the Bow basis. And the first three striations also produce familiar bases. So the whole set of five can be constructed in this way. There is some freedom here, again. Although this formalism tells you how to assign a frame to each striation, each set of parallel lines, it doesn't tell you exactly what vector to associate with each line. So there's some freedom there. Once you associate a vector with, say, that first line, the one on the left, then you can use the translation operators, which operate on Hilbert space, on the state space, to produce vectors to associate with the other lines in that striation. And so there's a certain amount of freedom. Then it turns out there's 64 different ways of making those choices. I'm just going to choose one of those ways in order for illustrative purposes. So just to illustrate a particular example of a Wigner function, I've made one particular choice, and I'll actually stick with this choice for the next few slides. So here is an example of a Wigner function for two qubits, just a couple of states. Consider the up-up state. That's one possible state of two qubits. This is what its Wigner function looks like. And you notice that if you sum over the columns, you get the right probabilities. Probability 1 of up-up, 0 for up-down, and so on. Sum horizontally, you get correct probability 1/4 of right-right, which is correct, and so on. And then you have these other funny tests that you can imagine, which correspond to these weird striations. And he gets the right probabilities for those, too, by construction. This over here is one of the Bell states, the singlet state, maximally entangled state of a pair of qubits. And it has a pretty simple Wigner function also. Not surprisingly, when you sum over the horizontal, over the vertical lines, over the columns, you get probability 1/2 of up down and probably 1/2 of down up, which is exactly what you do. Oh, I forgot to normalize that. I just didn't clutter the slide too much to put the normalization. So that's not normalized, but the probabilities should be 1/2 and 1/2. If you sum vertically, horizontally, you get that the probability of right left is 1/2 and the probability of left right is 1/2. That's not obvious from looking at the form of the state, but it is true of that state. And probability of right right, for example, is 0, which is true of that state. And similarly, you can get other probabilities by summing over other lines, funny lines, for example. Okay, a neat thing about this discrete Wigner function that sort of just comes out automatically from this construction is how do you compute the trace of the product of two different quantum states as given by their density matrices. That's useful for finding the probability that this state will be, you know, measured as this state if you perform that test. You just sum up the products of the corresponding Wigner functions over all the points in the phase space. So alpha has 16 values for this 4x4 space. You're summing over all of those. It leads me to the, with this particular, just giving examples of this, with this particular definition of the Wigner function for a pair of qubits, not yet generalizing to bigger things, I've drawn here all states. These are actual quantum states. These are Wigner functions of quantum states, where the white squares indicate a 0 in the Wigner function, and the red squares indicate 1/4. So we have 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, and 0 everywhere else. These are all actual possible quantum states. These are their Wigner functions. And these are all of the ones that have only 4 non-zero entries. There are 48 of them. Some of them are along lines that we might recognize, like this one on the lower left. That's the up-up state again. But then some of them are not along lines. It's interesting. This reminds me of Rob Speckin's toy model, but it's not the same as toy model as his toy model. You can interpret these things. If the world were such that these were the only states allowed for a pair of qubits, then it would be a simple classical interpretation of this. You could say that the actual state of the world is one of these 16 squares. And when you know a quantum state, when you have a quantum state, it's a state of knowledge. This is definitely in the spirit of Rob Speckin's work and others, where these are the possible states that you're allowed. And then if you just use your classical intuition to figure out what's the probability, if this is my state of knowledge, and I measure, say, is the particle in the lowest horizontal line, the probability will be 1/4, because there's only one of those four squares that actually lies in the bottom horizontal line. And that would be correct. And that kind of intuition gets you all the correct probabilities for this particular set of states. Now, the real world is not like that, okay? These are not the only states that are allowed, but if they were, you could have that kind of theory. Okay, and by the way, you can also ask, what's the maximum number of states in quantum mechanics, say for two qubits, that you can do this with, do this kind of trick with? And it's conceivable that this Wigner function approach actually gives you the maximum number of those, which is 48. I'm not sure if that's really true. Okay, just quickly note that this whole structure can be generalized to arbitrary finite fields. The finite fields always have a size. The number of elements is always a power of a prime. So the dimension of your state space has to be a power of a prime. That's in quantum computation world, that's fine, because we often have a bunch of qubits where the dimension is 2 to the n, where n is the number of qubits. And then you have your big phase spaces, this array of points. You have Q and P, which are elements of the finite field. I'm not going to great detail on this. You write those field elements in terms of a basis for the field, and then use the coefficients in that decomposition to define translation operators. And lo and behold, when you do the whole construction, you automatically get a set of D plus 1, dimension plus 1, mutually unbiased bases for this D-dimensional state space, which is kind of not all obvious. I mean, people had found those before, but this is a neat way to get them. Okay, let's see. Just note a very recent result by a couple of Perimeter Institute folk and some others, the discrete Wigner function and classicality. So these people considered the set of pure states, so this is an arbitrary dimension that's a power of a prime, having non-negative Wigner function for all of the possible definitions. You know, there was this freedom in defining the Wigner function, but suppose you insist that it be non-negative for all of these possible definitions of the Wigner function. And that defines a specific set of states. It turns out that those states are classical in a certain sense, in that, first of all, their description grows polynomially, in fact, even linearly, with a number of particles, as opposed to exponentially. And the unitary transformations that move these things around, that preserve this set of states, can be simulated efficiently on a classical computer. So there's something classical about positivity of the Wigner function if you insist on positivity for all of the possible definitions of the Wigner function. That's a nice result, and very recent. Okay, and that is pretty much gets me to the end of my talk. I just have a slide of conclusions and a slide of open questions. So main conclusions: we can express quantum states of a discrete system as real functions on a discrete phase space, not probability distributions necessarily. They can be negative, but they do add up to one like a probability distribution. And you can get good probability distributions from them, okay? Just that they themselves are not quite probability distributions. Also, complete sets of mutually unbiased bases for state space emerge naturally from this construction, and these bases can be used for tomography in the way that, or for reconstructing a quantum state. Also, this last result, the positivity of the Wigner function, has quantum computational implications. Maybe there's much more yet to be learned about that. Some open problems. I've been interested a bit in classifying all these possible definitions. So you have a lot of different ways of defining the Wigner function in this way, because there's some ambiguity about what vector you associate with each line of the state space. I'd like to classify those. It's also be nice maybe to figure out if there's some way to pick out a natural, sort of simplest definition of the Wigner function. I haven't come up with such a thing yet. Here's a question. For any dimension D, does there exist a definition of the Wigner function such that products are represented faithfully, in the sense that the Wigner function of a product state is itself a product of Wigner functions. And that turns out to be true if if the dimension is a power of an odd prime. That was proved by Pittenger and Rubin. Not known if it's a power of an even prime, unless the power is 1. There's only one even prime. And so two, if D is 2, you can do this. But it's not known. I'm sorry. And if the power is 2, that also works. If the power is 1, this is absolutely meaningless. If the power is 2, you can do it. You can take 2 qubits. They can separate in this way. Also, it'd be interesting to explore further the relation of this Wigner function business to toy models of quantum mechanics, which look kind of similar. that this is actual quantum mechanics and the toy models are not actual quantum mechanics. And so it's interesting to ask, in what ways are they different? And finally, I'm interested in continuous phase space. Suppose, if you go up through these finite dimensions via the odd primes, you get something that looks sort of like the Wigner function for the ordinary old Wigner function for a particle moving in one continuous dimension. But if you go up in other ways, it looks like you might get something different, and I wonder what those different things are. So that's another thing to explore. Okay, I think that's it, and thank you very much. All right.